morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Once again, we enter the Augustan age with today's monthly change of humanity's most recent calendar. This month, a memorial to the ancient Roman Emperor Augustus, who succeeded his stepfather Julius Caesar, whose murder by 40 or so knives he avenged and also abolished the Roman Republic, which had by then rotted to farce, adventing nearly half a millennium of Mediterranean empire until those nasty Germans and other subsequent hordes of barbarians demolished it. Perhaps more a casualty to Christianity than any other creed. August is also the month in which was ended the most titanic war so far in human history, with the horrible advent of the nuclear age by the explosions of two atomic bombs on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki that might just supplant the legends of Sodom and Gomorrah as history's greatest evils. August is also my birthday. And now, something apropos that I have written and once more reorate on this program. The Road to Mandala. And I wrote it many years ago for my newspaper, North Coast Times Eagle. His teacher said he should die in North America. North America was a mandala. Everything was there. He had spent his life in Japan. He had been a nuclear engineer before he took the vows of a Buddhist monk. His life was devoted to peace and the belief that a new age was approaching, preceded by a time of disaster that would clean away the rot of the old. The United States was particularly important to the future, his teacher said. The shadows that would cross the earth before the brightness would darken the United States first. Prophecies were not guarantees, but paradoxes, his teacher warned. Only the hard work and sacrifice of men and women who cherished peace and harmony would light the darkness. Anything less, and the earth would soon be as dead as its moon. He must be a candle, his teacher urged. There was no other purpose for a priest. His name was Suzuki Katsumi. He had been a monk 2 years, and a year before that, he had helped build a pagoda dedicated to world peace in Ceylon, the island nation of Sri Lanka. He left Japan with 6 other monks. He arrived in North America on the anniversary of his youngest uncle's death, attempting to crash his warplane into an American warship. For 3 months, he walked across the continent with American Indians who sought redress for broken promises and forsaken treaties. He lived in Canada almost a year and spent a winter in a cabin on an island in Puget Sound. After a month of nonviolent protest against construction of a nuclear submarine base near Seattle, he hitchhiked down the Oregon coast toward California, where he was to join the Indians once more, this time in an effort to halt the building of a nuclear power plant on treaty lands and to prevent the ravaging of the Black Hills for uranium. He wore his monk's robes wherever he went, even standing alongside a road. His vestments were startling. Over a gown white as bone was a robe more orange than a sunset. At his sandaled feet was a small Boy Scout haversack that was filled with rice wrapped in cellophane plastic, fresh tabby socks, a toothbrush, and a half-filled pouch of cigarette tobacco he had found on the roadway. He did not raise his thumb at passing cars, only his eyes, while he patiently beat on a small drum and chanted. He stayed 3 days at an old motel near Arch Cape as a guest of its owner. Several times a day he walked across a meadow that sloped above the beach and sat on a wood bench surrounded by spruce trees and salal bushes on 3 sides. The open side faced the ocean. There he beat his drum and chanted for hours. The chant was his single contribution, his weapon, and his prayer. Suzuki the monk hardly resembled his past incarnation, Suzuki the nuclear engineer. When he spoke of his former self, it was briefly and only to make a point. The point was generally that he had come so far around from what he had been, so could anyone else. The point was that he had been wrong, and now he felt he was doing what he needed to be done. Briefly, the former Suzuki had been in love with money and technology. He was ambitious and intensely competitive. His vision of the future was dramatically opposite monk Suzuki's, and he chanted in a more obscure and specialized idiom. He helped design nuclear power plants and engineering systems. He is not sure when he first noticed his own core was suffering a meltdown. He thought he had lost his soul. He went to India, the ancient holy land where the Buddha was born, to find himself. He visited temples and followed the travels of Gautama. He went to the holy land of Ceylon to climb a holy mountain and there met a Japanese monk who told him that a pagoda to peace was being built on the mountain. He thought he would stay and help only a few days. He was on the mountain a year, and afterward he became a monk. Almost a year later, he received information from the United States that American Indians were walking across the country from San Francisco to Washington, D.C. His spiritual master had told him many times that the USA was a vital key to the future. Peoples and religions from every part of the world had immigrated to the United States. Such diversity, thrown so closely together, could erupt in explosion or cohabit as a model of harmony. That was where his work should be. Do not come back to Japan, the old monk told the younger monk. Die in North America. By the time Suzuki reached the United States, the Indians had already walked to Illinois. There he joined them, and for 3 months he stayed with them, sleeping in prairies and woods, walking 25 miles each day, chanting each mile. He went to Canada afterward. He helped organize a cultural exchange between Indians living in Canada and their counterparts in Japan, the Ainu, who had been dispossessed of their ancestral islands by the Japanese invaders more than 1,000 years ago. He lived in Vancouver, British Columbia, for 6 months, then wintered on Quadra Island in Puget Sound. He lived in a cabin and spent the days watching eagles as they hunted in the sky over the island. In the spring, he came down to Ground Zero. That was the name of a group that had formed to nonviolently protest, halt, or otherwise confound construction of a Trident nuclear submarine base outside Seattle. Each day he spent with the group, he walked to a fence surrounding the project and chanted. After a month, he started along the coast for California. Sitting on the bench overlooking the Pacific Ocean, he explained the importance of his chant. It was not the words so much as the repetition, he said. The repetition emptied the mind and opened the soul. Over and over and over again. Inner happiness was the result of chanting, and happiness spread from one to many. To him, it was that simple. Happy people do not make war upon one another. They do not despise, cheat, lie, or do harm to each other. Chanting, he said, was the beginning of harmony and sharing. Suzuki is a monk of the sect known as Japan Buddha Sangha, which studies only ancient Sanskrit and has been involved in nonviolent protest against war for more than half a century. During World War II, most of its members were in jail or exile. After the war, they built 40 peace pagodas throughout Japan. Suzuki said that an international peace conference was planned by several groups in Japan. The conference was to be held in either Tokyo or Hiroshima. He favored Hiroshima. Americans remember Pearl Harbor. Japanese remember Hiroshima, he said. Every year there is International Conference Against Atomic War in Hiroshima. Every August 6th, when bomb drop. In Japan, spiritual conference, not propaganda, not technique, very spiritual. We hope to make religious nonviolence against all kinds of war. Peace movement in Japan and the world split so many times like cells in body, but body is whole. We want to make peace whole again. California was more immediate. He was going to help the American Indian movement in a three-pronged demonstration that started with a marathon. The tribes had run from San Francisco to Los Angeles. Each day, runners from several tribes, including, Suzuki said, a tribe from Japan, ran 10-mile relays for a daily total of 100 miles. He would join them in Los Angeles, where the Indians and their supporters would split up into three caravans. The first caravan would go to Diablo Canyon for a large demonstration against a nuclear power station the utilities would like to build on Indian land. The second group planned a longer journey. It was going to the Black Hills in South Dakota. Businessmen want uranium like ancestor wants gold 100 years ago, Suzuki said. Government say land belonged to Sioux, but underground belonged to government. The final caravan would go up the Calamus River near Crescent City. Last year, FBI killed two Indians for salmon fishing. This year become more excitement, Suzuki said. He would join the third group. One monk go to Diablo Canyon. Another monk go Black Hills. If I choose, I go to Diablo as former nuclear engineer. But it make no difference. Any place I go, it is the same. Canada, Oregon, Washington, California, it make no difference. He said that he and the other monks who worked for peace followed the Lotus Flower Sutra. Written as a proclamation of the Buddha, this part was Suzuki's guide and his goal. Those who are not saved, I will save. Those who are not free, I will set free. Those who are not comforted, I will comfort. Quote, unquote. He told the story of another monk who was his spiritual example. Long time ago, one monk, not very smart. He is poor in the head. He always do same action. He meet people, and he bow, and he say, I am reverence and respect to you. I never look down on you, because someday you practice Buddha's Dharma and become Buddha. I am respect to you. Quote, unquote. Some people think he crazy monk. Some people throw rocks to him, and he run away. But he all the time turn around and bow, and he say, I am respect to you. More rocks come, and he run, stop, bow, and say, I am respect to you. All the time, everywhere he go, he always do same action. This dumb monk, he's smarter than all the rest of the people. He is Buddha before reincarnation. We are following the same action, chanting and beating drum. This how we meet businessman and soldier. We bow and make respect to them. Sometimes they throw rocks to us, but no matter. Somebody already punched at me. I was very glad. And that was Suzuki. He even seemed pleased that some Americans called him a Jap. Japa in Sanskrit mean chant, he said. Japa Mara is holy necklace for chanting. So they call me Jap is what I am and what I do. I am laughing when I am called Jap. Like many others, Suzuki felt the immediate future would be one of catastrophe. Almost everything was coming to crisis at once. Overpopulation and worldwide food shortages, pollution of the skies, the oceans, rivers, and lakes, that sickened and killed natural life, as well as increasing numbers of humans. Energy shortages that, combined with the rest, might conceivably drive desperate nations into series of wars that culminate in a war more horrible than any the world had experienced. He also believed that natural disasters would increase and add millions to the casualty lists. But unlike other doom prophets, Suzuki believed that the disasters were only a prologue to a new age greater than any other. The human race would come to full fruit. The brain and the soul would finally be united. Already, Suzuki saw glimmerings. The political uprisings throughout the world were not radical, he said. They were simple demands that humanity reverse its headlong rush to oblivion. Although he accused the industrial nations of overconsumption and waste, within his own country and the United States, he saw examples of lifestyles based on conservation and sharing and the use of natural energy sources. These he called New Age. They were New Age ideas, New Age people. Suzuki's eyes were fixed past the rubble of the past century. He said that everywhere he went, he looked for the New Age, and because he believed so strongly in the New Age, he did not fear the time of troubles just ahead. Suzuki's life was the mirror of his beliefs. It might be said that he walked his talk. His ministry was the road. "I am hippie monk," he said. "No home, no temple, no money, just walking. Sometimes hungry, sometimes cold, sometimes doubt, sometimes jail. Jesus say, don't keep food, money, clothes. Keep walking and believe in God. New Age people don't need heroes. We already have Jesus, Mary, and Buddha. The Jones family, Charles Manson, Sun Moon, and Billy Graham, all imitation." Before he went back on the road, he said that the United States was a mandala, that every ingredient for the future was within its borders. The people, the ideas, and the strength to endure and ultimately prevail over the hard times ahead. But he said that all the hateful isms that cripple humanity must be ruthlessly exorcised. Racism, sexism, these had to be eliminated if the human race is to pull together and create the new age. Until then, each moment is a miracle, Suzuki said. And that was something I wrote for my now defunct newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle, The Road to Mandala. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is engineer of this program. If the grand old party of the Republic is either unwilling or incapable of choosing another candidate for president of the USA, then the indicted criminal and serial liar, Donald Trump, whose initial tenure as president of the USA is overwhelmingly considered the worst in America's history, it deserves to be roundly defeated this November, and perhaps should regroup and reorganize in the same manner as it was forced to do in the mid-19th century and produced the immortal presidency of Abraham Lincoln. And now, by Frank Bruni for the New York Times. Strong women are driving Donald Trump crazy. It's always a good idea to pay attention to Nancy Pelosi and to judge where things are going by which direction she is nudging them in. But that was especially true over the past few weeks. When she started sending President Biden signals that he should reconsider his candidacy, I felt almost certain that he would eventually do so, because she was both giving other Democrats permission to break ranks with him and letting him and his allies know the extent and inevitability of the rebellion. and I realized that Vice President Kamala Harris would not face any competition for the Democratic nomination when Pelosi endorsed her. That was the sign. In other words, Pelosi, a woman who so ably foiled Donald Trump when he was president and she was House Speaker, helped make it possible and then confirmed that another woman, Harris, would lead the charge to foil him from beginning president again. It is a veritable Hollywood movie. Women are scripting what will happen to Trump, who has treated women with such cruelty and contempt. They still don't enjoy full equality with men in America, but we sure have been leaning on them lately to save American democracy. The appalling, stymied attempts to hold Trump responsible for his crimes have rested largely on the efforts of women, a few of whom did vanquish him in court, as my Times opinion colleague Jessica Bennett noted in an essay in April. She did a roll call of his pursuers, Letitia James, Fannie Willis, E. Jean Carroll, and her lawyer, Roberta Kaplan, and, of course, Stormy Daniels, the five women who are living rent-free in Mr. Trump's mind these days, quote, unquote. I would add, crazy Nancy Pelosi. Trump is still regularly calling her that, unable to purge her from his thoughts, to the list. Jessica wrote about Pelosi in an essay. Also, former Representative Liz Cheney. Nobody on the House panel investigating the events of January 6, 2021, was more forceful or impassioned than she was in exposing Trump's actions and inaction on that day. She, too, squats somewhere in Trump's gray matter, so much so that he recently amplified social media posts that accused her of treason and urged that she be subjected to a televised military tribunal. Jessica made her rent-free, and that's a quote, observation on the eve of Trump's trial in Manhattan for falsifying business records to cover up an alleged dalliance with Daniels, and that proceeding has been so completely overtaken and overshadowed by subsequent events that it might as well have happened in the Ice Age. Fresher developments include Biden's cataclysmic debate performance, many Democrats' demands that he end his campaign, and their despair when he resisted, talking about all he had accomplished and how nobody was a more potent foe for Trump. Who do you suppose was tasked with taking on that male vanity? Women. Joe Biden was exhorted to make everything right. Or was it Valerie Biden's job? Or Pelosi's? Hunter Biden was reportedly hunkered down with Dad. But did anyone demand that he tame the paterfamilias? Not that I heard or read. Women were given the heaping measure of responsibility, though they often get only a soup con of credit. I do sense progress. When people discussed who might be a stronger Democratic nominee than Biden, and the names of Governor Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan and Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo rightly came up, few dissenters questioned their electability on the ground that they're women.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times-Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.